November 1942, Friday the 13th. The dark, stormy heights of the Pyrenees. Virginia Hall was scrambling along a precarious ledge. The wind pushed her towards the sheer drop to her left, then battered her towards the thick slab of mountain to her right. The snow was several feet deep, pulling at her feet with every step. Beneath her thick winter pants, blood seeped from her knee where her leg strapped onto its prosthetic bottom. How much longer could she keep going? Few attempted this 5,000-foot climb in the winter months. Even fewer made it through. It was grueling under the best circumstances. These were the worst circumstances. Virginia pressed her lips together. She could endure this pain. Thrusting her body forward into the violent wind with each step, she kept up with her passer, or mountain guide, and his two other charges. There was no choice but to keep going forward, into Spain, because behind Virginia were the Nazis. The facade of the Vichy regime and the so-called Free Zone was over. All of France was occupied. That alone wouldn't have convinced Virginia to leave, but the Nazis knew her face. They'd plastered it all over the country, and they'd captioned it, "The enemy's most dangerous spy. We must find and destroy her." After more than a year of skillful organizing, ingenious sabotage, and constant benzedrine-fueled vigilance in the field, it was time to head back to London and debrief. But first, she would have to survive the climb. This is Espionage, the Parcast original exploring the missions of the world's most incredible spies and what brought their covert operations into the public eye. Throughout this show, we'll explore real-world spy tactics required to impersonate, exploit, and infiltrate the most confidential places in the world. I'm Carter Roy. At Parcast, we are grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. And if you enjoy today's episode, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. It really does help. We also now have merchandise. Head to parcast.com/merch for more information. This is our second and final episode on Virginia Hall, an American woman at the heart of World War II's French resistance. By the end of the war, her name would be printed in the records of the British Secret Service SOE more times than any other agent. She changed the game for the Allied war effort and changed British intelligence's perspective on female agents while she was at it. Virginia concentrated on keeping her hands still. She wanted to pull at her sleeves and her rings and her dyed brown hair as she walked. She was nervous. She kept glancing left at George Whittinghill, her prize recruit and Lyon's American vice consul. He was smiling confidently and serenely. She'd questioned him enough times. "Are you sure she's the right person?" He'd promised. He was sure. She didn't like this. She'd heard the disgusted whispers of horizontal collaboration amongst the SOE's agents and her French contacts. She knew that Lyon's sex workers served the Nazis. But she desperately needed to find allies and start building her circuit, which would be codenamed Heckler. Headquarters was relying on her to keep SOE alive behind enemy lines. She'd have to find those allies wherever she could. And Germaine Guérin, Lyon's most successful madam, was apparently a true patriot and as discreet as they came. The foyer was elegant, surrounded by twisting corridors and dark, perfumed rooms. But Nazis passed through these rooms every night, Virginia reminded herself. Could she work with someone who served the Nazis so intimately, so closely? And then Virginia saw Germaine. She smiled at Virginia coyly. This was a woman with just as much charm as Virginia herself. Her expression was secretive and alluring. She was dazzlingly elegant, dripping in furs and jewelry. The war rations made luxuries scarce. And she exuded control, with good reason. She had half of Lyon's most powerful men eating out of her palm. They loved her and her girls, but they also trusted her. Her steely, unshakable discretion was part of what made her such an excellent madam. It would also make her an excellent agent for the SOE. Virginia and Germaine sized one another up. They came from very different worlds. Virginia, for all her moxie and independence, was eminently respectable. She had grown up taking vacations to Europe with her family and learning French and German at private secondary schools and colleges. Germaine, for all her diamonds and pearls, had pulled herself out of Lyon's streets. But Virginia recognized that sharp look beneath Germaine's dark-lined lids as she took in Virginia's face, her clothes, her slight limp. It was the look of someone who never missed a single detail, a look not unlike Virginia's own. Whittinghill, still smiling, slipped away to let them talk. Their meeting, he thought, would be a success. Germaine knew, thanks to Whittinghill, that Virginia was working for London, though he'd left the specifics vague. She knew this was her chance to join the resistance and make a real contribution towards the fight against the Nazis. So she took an enormous risk and laid all her cards on the table. There were as many patriots among France's working girls as anywhere else, she explained to Virginia. Many were willing to risk their lives to defeat the Nazis. And she, with their help, had been hiding Jews and other escapees from Nazi persecution. Her house was full of dark corners, she pointed out. Her girls had their secrets, too. Virginia listened. Despite herself, she was impressed with this woman. Germaine and her girls had already displayed an enormous amount of courage and discretion, too. She put aside her prejudices and explained her position. Most of her colleagues had been arrested last month at the Villa de Bois in Marseille. It was up to her to build a circuit, to start organizing and developing the French resistance into something coherent and powerful. She'd already started putting together an impressive network of contacts and informants who could feed the circuit intel. There was Suzanne Bertillon, the Vichy chief censor of the foreign press, the 90 Gaullist informers Bertillon had put her in touch with, and her prize recruit in Lyon, the American vice consul, George Whittinghill, who could get messages to and from London. But a circuit was more than a group of informers. The SOE needed résistants, trained and ready to actively sabotage the Nazis. They were willing to provide weapons, money, and supplies to support that training and sabotage. Ultimately, when the Allies landed in France, they'd need the circuits to rise up and fight as a guerrilla army backing the Allied troops. Virginia needed fighters. But they had to look completely innocent. They had to work under the noses of the Nazis without ever being noticed. Germaine smiled that coy smile once again. She knew just the people to start with. Virginia's alliance with Germaine would be crucial to the SOE's success in Lyon. Under their joint direction, a number of Lyon's sex workers started actively working for the resistance. They rifled through the pockets of their sleeping Nazi customers and photographed any papers they found. They hid increasing numbers of escapees in their back rooms, and they drugged the Nazis' drinks, then coaxed them into spilling whatever information they had. In the morning, it wasn't hard to convince the confused men that they'd overdone it on the liquor. They never remembered a thing. Through Germain, Virginia also met and recruited some of the Frenchmen amongst the highest strata of Lyon society. This set of upper echelon brothel patrons provided Virginia with valuable resources like safe houses, food, and gasoline for cars. They could also move around France more easily than the average Frenchman and helped her get messages to and from the other five SOE agents around the country. One of these new contacts, Eugène Genet, gave Virginia the most valuable gift of all, the ear of his brother, the Lyon police chief. With his help, Virginia would have advanced warning of every police raid. There was only one man, though, that Virginia trusted as much as Germain, the gynecologist, Dr. Jean Rousset. On the surface, he was a cheery, chubby-cheeked man. He provided health care to Lyon's sex workers, working closely with Germain at her brothel. But his twinkling smile and good-natured banter hid enormous reserves of courage and strength. Like Germain, he'd been risking his life sheltering Jews since 1940. But Rousset was determined to do more than shelter a few men. He was willing to do whatever it took to get the Nazis out of France, he told Virginia. She took him on as her right-hand man. He helped her make new contacts in Lyon and beyond. He set up a mental asylum in his offices that served as a formal SOE safe house. He helped coordinate the journeys of fallen Allied pilots and runaway Jews into neutral Spain. And he let Virginia use his offices as her poste de commande, or headquarters. Their cover was that he was her doctor, and she was simply visiting him for treatment. Rousset also directed his own diabolical scheme. With the help of Germain's girls and Virginia's blessing, he helped Lyon's sex workers infect their patrons with syphilis and gonorrhea by giving infected girls clean cards of health. He'd provide the women with treatment once they'd spread their infection to as many Nazis as possible. It was a cruel scheme run by a very kind man. But these were desperate times. Anything that put Nazis out of commission was fair game. Heckler was shaping up nicely. It wasn't hard for Virginia to find new recruits in Lyon, especially not once she had the well-connected, trusted Lyonnais Germain and Rousset on her side. Hatred of the Nazis dripped through Lyon's streets like a slow-acting poison. But Virginia didn't open up her circuit to every angry resident of the city. The louder dissidents, who voiced their anger with dangerous confidence in coffeehouses under their real names, were a liability. Virginia knew if she and her circuit were going to survive, every single person she worked with had to be more than loyal to the cause. They had to be secretive, careful types, the kind with little ego and less carelessness, the kind who were, more or less, something like her. She found her people waiting quietly in Lyon's stores, whispering softly with Germain's girls or Rousset's nurses and serving Nazis in stony silence. She found hairdressers. They helped change the appearance of anyone on the run. She found engravers. They forged papers for escapees. She found a laundry worker who passed messages from résistant to résistant. According to Sonia Purnell, author of A Woman of No Importance, The Untold Story of the American Spy Who Helped Win World War II, the laundry woman would place two stockings close together in the unremarkable windows of her laundry when she had a message to share. She placed them far apart when she had nothing. But Virginia's reach was also spreading beyond Lyon. She even infiltrated the notorious Sûreté, the French counterterrorism force that worked tirelessly in service of Nazi goals. She now had forewarning if résistants or agents were going to be arrested by either the police or the Sûreté, just enough time to move them to a safe house. Soon enough, the recruits were coming to her, offering their services. Word quickly spread around France. If you needed a place to hide and aid getting out of France, you headed down to Lyon and looked for Marie Mona. She'd find you a safe house. She'd get you medical help. She'd give you money and train tickets and contacts in the southwest, where you could cross the Pyrenees into neutral Spain. But Virginia's success and notoriety came with a price. Every time the Nazis arrested a résistant or a downed Allied pilot in France, they'd torture them for intel on the Allied forces and the resistance. They started to hear one name again and again. Marie Mona. Sometimes they'd hear other names. La Dame qui boite, the lady who limps. Sometimes they'd eke out agonized admissions. She wasn't French, they'd say. Maybe British. Maybe Canadian. Whoever she was the one who was supposed to get them out of France. And she was in Lyon. The Nazis were on to her. Next, we'll hear how the Nazis started to close in on Virginia and her circuit, and the incredible mission she accomplished right under their noses. Now back to the story. The Nazis were zeroing in on Lyon and the Lady Who Limps as Marie Mona's notoriety spread through France. Then, on December 7, 1941, Japan bombed Pearl Harbor. The U.S. was officially at war. And Virginia's cover as an American reporter with the New York Post was no longer much protection. Pétain launched a violently renewed crackdown on resistance efforts across the Free Zone. SOE headquarters asked Virginia if she wanted to return to London. After 3 months in France, she'd already stayed alive and undiscovered in enemy territory longer than most agents. But Virginia insisted on staying in the field. Things were going too well to leave now. Every kind of rebel and escapee passed through her doors, and her circuit needed her leadership to function. But she had another, bigger reason to stay in France. Virginia had started working on her boldest, most dangerous mission yet. She wasn't sure if it was possible, but no one else was going to try. She wanted to break the 12 men arrested at the Villa de Bois out of prison. The mass arrest at the villa in late October 1941 had been the most disastrous event of the SOE's short history. If she could get those 12 men back into the field, the SOE would have a full stable of agents to work with. It would make an enormous difference. But it would take a perfect plan. The men were locked in an impenetrable fortress. First of all, Virginia needed to get them transferred to a less secure prison. But she had an idea. She traveled to Vichy, the Free Zone capital, to meet with Fleet Admiral Leahy, the American ambassador. Well, she had never been able to establish a good relationship with him when she was working in Vichy. He didn't like spies interfering in his diplomatic territory, at least not American ones who'd be associated with him if they were caught. But things had changed since then. The U.S. was at war. Virginia sat on the train, broad-brimmed hat pulled low on her forehead, and prepared her argument. Virginia faced off with Leahy in March 1941, eschewing the charming flattery she often used with men. It had never worked on single-minded, fastidious Leahy. Instead, she cleared her throat and made her case clearly. The U.S. was part of this fight now. The 12 Villa de Bois soldiers were British and Frenchmen, and they were rotting in a moldy, damp fortress enduring torture and starvation. It simply wasn't right. There had to be something Leahy could do, some kind of diplomatic strings he could pull, to move these brave men somewhere more humane. Or, Virginia's tone changed, the newspapers in the U.S. would surely have something to say about it. She made it clear this was a threat. Leahy was annoyed by the threat, but he was impressed by Virginia's speech despite himself. He knew that she was right. The tide of opinion in the U.S. had turned against Vichy. They wanted to see their country contributing to this war. He'd try to get the men moved, he promised. Virginia left, delighted. Her ploy had worked, and Leahy had no idea this was just the beginning of her plan. In March 1941, all 12 men were transferred to an internment camp at Mozac, in the west of the Free Zone. The fortress had been impenetrable, but Mozac, she could get them out of. It was too dangerous for Virginia or her agents to get too close to Mozac, she knew, but the families of the jailed men could. One of the agents had a French wife, Gabby Blush. Virginia recruited her. Virginia prepared Gabby carefully. Go to the bar near the camp and chat with a prison guard, she instructed. Hint at your loyalties to the Allies. Hint that you have money. See if you get a response. It was risky, as always, to express any kind of anti-Nazi sentiment, but the ploy worked. One of the guards sidled up to the pretty French woman and indicated that he was willing to help. With Gabby and the compliant, well-paid guard on her side, Virginia and the men inside Mozac were able to communicate. They started to formulate a plan and a list of things they'd need to make it work. A key to unlock their door, an unmanned guard tower, something to push apart the barbed wire surrounding the camp, something to protect themselves from the barbs while they slithered out. Virginia slowly figured out how to get the men their supplies. Gabby brought canned goods to her husband. One of the men, a handyman before the war, would use the metal from the cans to fashion a key. The men requested permission to fix up their cabin, and Gabby brought them a rug and wood so they could build a little trestle table. They'd use the rug and table to get through the barbed wire. Meanwhile, the guard they'd recruited convinced his superiors to leave one of the watchtowers unmanned. It was structurally unsound and might harm a guard, he insisted. The men would have their blind spot to work through. Virginia actually even managed, miraculously, to smuggle them a radio transmitter under the robes of a priest. The men were transmitting from within a Vichy prison camp. But in July, the transmission stopped. It was time to break out. On July 15th, 1942, an old lady walked past the camp with two little children following her. This was the signal. If it had been an old man with the children, the men would have known it was all off. The friendly guard got his chief drunk, then at 3 a.m. gave the all clear. He lit his pipe on top of one of the watchtowers. The men unlocked their door with the secretly crafted key. They sprinted through the shadows to the barbed wire fence, where they pushed their decorative table between two wires to create a crawl space. They lay the carpet on the ground beneath the table, over the bottommost wire. It would protect their stomachs as they slithered through, and then they started to crawl. It took about a minute for each of the men to make it to the other side. As the last one prepared to wiggle through, a guard loomed over him. He froze. The guard whispered, "Is it the English?" The escapee hissed, "Yes." "Well," the guard replied, "don't make so much noise." He walked away. The men were out. They were far from safe on the other side of the fence, but Virginia had someone there to meet them. The escape route was all planned. Every single one of the 12 men made it to Lyon, then to Spain, and from there to London. Many of them went on to play major roles in the SOE over the course of the war. Virginia had succeeded in planning and executing one of the most miraculous prison breaks of World War II. And this wouldn't be the only prison break she'd orchestrate. They became something of her specialty. She'd get one man out by smuggling him SOE's so-called sickness pills, which caused the same symptoms as typhoid: extreme stomach cramps, high fever. From there, with help from a doctor recruit, she broke him out of the hospital. Others she'd free through well-placed bribes. By the end of the war, SOE headquarters recorded she'd orchestrated a very great number of escapes. But prison breaks weren't the only thing on Virginia's plate throughout the spring and summer of 1942. The Nazis were closing in on the French spy known only as Marie Monnat. After Mossack, things only got worse. The Gestapo, the Nazi secret police, was furious. They were arresting and torturing anyone they even suspected was part of the resistance. The resistants were cracking under torture. Entire circuits were being wiped out. It was only a matter of time before they cracked Heckler. SOE headquarters was alarmed. Eventually, someone who knew Virginia's real identity, or at least where to find her, was going to get caught. And if they were caught, odds were they would crack. London called Virginia home a second time, but Virginia, again, said no. She'd stay just a bit longer. She was well aware of the mounting danger. She was constantly on edge, foregoing sleep to watch the street from her window and popping Benzedrine to stay alert. She amped up security. She started seeing fewer of her contacts. She cut off communication with some of the SOE's other agents, and she kept moving house. But she had several other prison breaks in the works, each of them as complicated as the first. And she finally had radio operators, which meant she was now able to coordinate supply and arms drops from Allied planes, then distribute those supplies and arms to Resistance. She could finally start training her men and women for the Allied invasion and the guerrilla war they'd help fight. But most of all, she knew that if she left, she couldn't take Germaine, Dr. Rousset, and the rest of her people with her. Maybe she'd save her life, but she'd be helpless to save theirs. How could she ask them to risk everything for her, then leave? As long as she was in Lyon, she could do everything possible to keep them alive, to keep Heckler alive, and to keep the constantly battered French resistance alive. She'd joined the SOE to change the course of this war, and every day she spent in France increased her conviction. These appallingly brutal Nazis could not be allowed to win. They tortured and killed people on nothing more than hearsay. They arrested free men and effectively enslaved them to work in their weapons factories, and they were slaughtering groups of people wholesale. Jews, gay people. The full extent of their brutality wouldn't be revealed until after the war, but Virginia knew enough. She had to keep up the fight. The atmosphere of constant tension was starting to take a toll on Virginia, though. It led to a major lapse of judgment at the end of August 1942. Robert Alesh, a Catholic clergyman, came to Lyon with valuable intel from a Paris circuit. But he arrived with red flags, too. He was a little too eager to know everything about her circuit, and he was suspiciously silent about a disastrous round of arrests that had struck his Paris circuit. He should have known, and he should have told Virginia, but he never mentioned it. Virginia would never normally have ignored those red flags, but despite noting them with some unease, Virginia took Alesh into her circuit. She introduced him to Germaine and to Rousset. His information seemed too good to turn away. He had maps and photographs on Nazi coastal defenses, and Paris had vetted him, after all. Trusting him was a mistake. Alesh worked for the Nazis. He passed them everything he learned from and about Virginia and her circuit. The apparently valuable information he gave her was doctored by the Nazis, so that it was more than useless, it was misleading and dangerous. Virginia's circuit was about to go up in flames. So was the Free Zone. The Allies were planning an invasion of North Africa. They, Virginia, and all of France knew what that would mean. The Nazis would flood southern France and seize all power from the Vichy government. They'd need total control of France's southern coastline to guard against the Allies across the Mediterranean. And Virginia knew that once the Nazis were officially in control of the south, her police and government contacts would be useless. She knew the Gestapo had to be on to her, although she didn't know the extent to which she and her circuit had been compromised by Alesh. She knew, in short, that if she was in Lyon once the Allies landed in North Africa, she'd die. But she still couldn't bear to run. Not yet. Not when every laundress, shopkeeper, and nurse who had worked for her had their lives on the line, too. She'd stay until she was more of a liability than a help. When the Allies invaded North Africa on November 8, 1942, Virginia was still in Lyon. Within hours, her network of powerful contacts throughout France was rendered useless. The government officials were no longer government officials. The police were no longer police. The Nazis were marching south. When we get back, we'll watch Virginia fight for her life against the worst odds yet. Now, back to the story. November 8th, 1942. Allied forces landed in Algiers, Oran, and Casablanca. The Nazis were marching south. As they closed in on Lyon, Virginia finally agreed with London. There was nothing left she could do here. She met with Germaine and Rousset one last time and handed over the last details of her ongoing prison breaks. She hugged her friends, tears in her eyes, but kept her mouth shut. They knew something was happening, but she didn't tell them what, and they knew better than to ask. Night had fallen. It was now or never. Virginia, with nothing more than a small bag in hand, rushed towards the train station. She couldn't run with her prosthetic leg, but she could walk awfully quickly. There was one last train at 11 p.m. Sweat was pouring down her forehead, melting her thick coating of makeup. That was bad. She'd need to be well disguised to make it out of here. But she couldn't slow down. If she wasn't on this train, disguise or no, she'd be dead. Her knee throbbed. Her heart pumped in her throat. She pulled herself up onto the train as it started to pull out of the station. She'd made it. Now, onto the Pyrenees. As her train sped towards Perpignan, the southernmost city in France, the Nazis descended on Lyon. Immediately, they started plastering flyers of Virginia's face, accurately described by Alesh, across the city. They were captioned, "The enemy's most dangerous spy. We must find and destroy her." Behind her was certain death. But moving forward was deadly, too. If Virginia had left France even a month earlier, she might have been able to find passage on a boat or a plane to Spain or Portugal. But it was too late for that now. There were no planes and no boats. The Nazis were flooding every corner of France and ruthlessly butchering anyone who stood in their way. There was only one way out, on foot, through the Pyrenees. On November 11th, with an inordinately expensive mountain guide and two other escapees, Virginia began the climb. The route was, of course, illegal, and the mountain passes were patrolled by Nazi guards, but it was the climb itself that was most dangerous of all. Icy winds whipped the cliff edges as they inched their way up the mountain. They were plowing through banks of snow several feet deep. Sharp chunks of ice fell regularly, just missing their heads. With her wooden legs silently and painfully hidden from the passer, Virginia was at a disadvantage in conditions that had killed many strong, fit men. But as she ground her teeth together and dragged her prosthetic up the cliff face, she thought of the people she'd left behind. Of Germaine and Rousset. She thought of the risks they'd face now as the Nazis poured through the twisting streets of Lyon and broke down doors, as they arrested and killed children whose neighbors had cried Jew or rebel. Maybe, once she was in London, she could still help them. Maybe she could craft a new disguise and return to France to continue fighting with her comrades. She had to make it through this climb. She was no use to them dead. She didn't know that as she was climbing on Friday the 13th, her right-hand man in Lyon, Dr. Rousset, was arrested. Thanks to Alesh, when the Nazis took over Lyon, they knew just who to look for. They knew Virginia's address, her face, her code names, and many of her circuit members. She'd survive to find out. Virginia Hall made it over the mountain, her prosthetic crumbling beneath her, her stump oozing blood, and her fingers blue. The climb, she'd later say, was the scariest part of her life overseas. She and the men she was traveling with slunk, bedraggled, starving, and exhausted, into a train station in San Juan at the very north of Spain. All they had to do was make it onto the very first early morning train to Barcelona, where the American embassy would welcome them. But that wasn't what happened. The Spanish Civil Guard was doing a routine check of the train station when they found Virginia and her companions, too exhausted to run, huddled in a corner. Virginia struggled to stand and explained in her passable Spanish that they had been out enjoying a hike. The Civil Guard laughed in her face. These three bodies hadn't been enjoying anything recently, that was clear. They carted her and her companions off to jail for being undocumented and destitute refugees. Finally, at the very end of her mission, Virginia had been captured. Not by the Vichy police, not by the Nazis, but by the neutral Spanish Civil Guard, who had no idea who she was. There was a hilarity to it, but it wasn't a joke. Spain's neutrality was tenuous. Virginia knew that if the Nazis requested she be transferred into their care, Spain would likely hand her over. She needed to get out of this cell before then. Luckily, she knew plenty about jailbreaks, and she had a simple plan for this one. When her cellmate, a sex worker from Barcelona, was released, Virginia convinced her to deliver a coded letter to the American consulate. The consulate, after decoding it, immediately started negotiating for Virginia's release. Within a week, she was out and on her way to Barcelona. Her mission, after 15 months on the ground, was complete. Virginia returned to London a hero. She could have easily stayed there, in relative safety at SOE headquarters, for the remainder of the war, but when she heard about the Nazis' savage destruction of her circuit in Lyon, her conviction that she was needed on the ground only grew. Germain and Rousset were at concentration camps in Germany. Almost everyone else was dead or arrested. Virginia was devastated. Her people had sacrificed everything. She couldn't stop fighting for them now. But the SOE wouldn't let her return to France, because they were sure she would be found out and killed. Maurice Buckmaster, the head of the F section of the SOE, wrote her a letter in response to her request for a new assignment in France. Quote, "You are too well known in the country, and it would be wishful thinking believing you could escape. We do not want to give the Germans even half a chance by sending in anyone as remarkable as yourself." It was a flattering refusal, but Virginia couldn't accept it. If the SOE wouldn't put her back on the ground, she'd find another job. The OSS, the SOE's American counterpart, was happy to hire her. It was still a new agency in 1943, and grateful to take on such an experienced agent. Virginia worked on the ground for the OSS until the end of the war. She worked as a radio operator and trained men to fight guerrilla style. And after the Allies landed in Normandy on June 6, 1944, she helped the French resistance seize control of the Haute-Loire area in south-central France without help from the formal Allied troops. And the SOE was wrong. Against all odds, she didn't die in the field. She went on to be the first woman to work in the CIA, mainly at its Washington headquarters. She married another ex-OSS agent, and she retired to a French-style country house in Maryland, the state where she was born. She lived to 76, passing away quietly in 1982. She died with awards for her service from the British and the Americans and the French. It's hard to underestimate the impact Virginia's work had on the war effort. Her name is the most mentioned of any agent in the SOE records. Almost every SOE agent active in France in 1941 or 1942 received some kind of help from her circuit, whether that was in the form of supplies, disguises, contacts, or intel. And Virginia did it all without ever officially being given the title of circuit chief. She fought for her authority in the field and gained it by showing success after success. Her most enduring impact may have ultimately been the effect she had on the SOE as an agency. She convinced headquarters that women could be effective agents. They could do everything male agents could do, and they could use men's prejudices against them on top of that. The Nazis were loath to accept that a silly, helpless woman could possibly be a spy. By the end of World War II, there wasn't a single war office or agency that could deny that women were as daring, as clever, and as effective as men in the field. The SOE would send 52 female agents into France after Virginia. Many of the lessons Virginia had taught the SOE during the war years, though, were ignored by the CIA. During her 20-year career there, she was passed over for promotions and leadership roles where she would doubtless have thrived. The sexism that plagued the beginning of her career in the State Department came back to haunt her at its end. But today, the CIA has come around to acknowledge Virginia's importance. On their website, they proudly claim her as one of their own, skating over the fact that they never appreciated her much when she was working for them. Today, it doesn't seem hard to acknowledge just what an extraordinary woman Miss Virginia Hall of Baltimore was. There are now 4 books written about her, 1 in French, 3 in English, all written in the past 15 years. A movie is in the works. Virginia Hall, who never wrote a memoir or gave an interview, has managed to capture the world's imagination. She didn't work for public glory, the best spies usually don't. She worked for freedom, her own and the freedom of everyone the Nazis threatened. She worked to prove that she could work, that she wasn't lesser because of her gender or her missing leg. And she succeeded beyond everyone's wildest expectations. Virginia Hall was the SOE's risky bet. In the end, she was its salvation. The agency dissolved after the war, its mission complete, and many of its records have been destroyed since then. But the ones that remain tell a compelling story. The story of an unlikely agent who became the pulse of the French Resistance. Thank you for listening to Espionage. We'll be back Friday with a new episode. For more information on Virginia Hall, amongst the many sources we used, we found A Woman of No Importance, The Untold Story of the American Spy Who Helped Win World War II by Sonia Purnell, extremely helpful to our research. You can find more episodes of Espionage, as well as all of Parcast's other shows, on Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Several of you have asked how to help us. If you enjoy the show, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll be back next week with another deep dive into the world of clandestine operation. Espionage was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound designed by Dick Schroeder, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Liebeskind. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Carly Madden. This episode of Espionage was written by Nora Battelle. I'm Carter Roy.